What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the last installment of the coffee series. Over the past 6 weeks, we've gone on a journey from tree to cup, talking all about horticulture and breeding, to talking about the problems that producers face, from the price crisis to environmental issues with the threat of climate change, changing rain patterns and moisture content in the soil, the onset of rampant diseases like coffee leaf rust. We've talked about various post-harvest management strategies. How do we maintain the quality once those beans come off the tree? How then can we then roast those beans and create a delicious product? And today we're going to be talking about the chemistry of coffee, the flavors and the aromas and all the things that go into producing this bouquet of deliciousness that we all have come to know and love in coffee. So I'm really excited to share the final installment of this series with you today with a researcher at Texas A&M and a PhD candidate. Her name is Sarah Brinkley, and I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it and learning from Sarah. She's a wealth of knowledge, and it was such a delight to wrap up this series with her and glean from her expertise. So thanks for joining me on this journey to learn more about what is sustainable coffee. Hopefully along this way, you've learned and gleaned some information on how to be more sustainable with this everyday purchase. And if you want to support me in the podcast, feel free to drop a like, a subscribe, a follow, and share this with your friends. All right, everyone, sit back, relax, and enjoy this last episode of What is Sustainable Coffee? Welcome to Environmentality, a podcast for environmental news, lectures, and interviews with the experts. I'm your host, Dr. Brendan Anthony. Let's dive on in. Welcome, everybody. Today, I have a very lovely guest on the show. Her name is Sarah Brinkley, and she is a researcher at Texas A&M in the Center for Coffee Research and Education. And we are so excited to have her on. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. So how about you give just a little bit of background on kind of how you got interested in coffee and agriculture and why you are now pursuing graduate degrees in this field?
For sure. Yeah, it's definitely like a long and winding road. Sure. My formal education is in chemistry. So I studied both master's and bachelor's at Tennessee Tech. And I guess I was looking at a career in a box full of fluorescent lighting, working in a lab. And for some reason, that just really didn't sit right with me.
Sure.
So, yeah. And I guess it was around the same time that craft beer was sort of making its way to the Southeast. And in our American Chemical Society, like undergrad club, we were doing a lot of food science, experimenting. We even built a siphon, a coffee brewer with like a Florence flask.
Very cool
stuff. Yeah. And so I was kind of gearing up for a PhD, got into a bunch of places, super, you know, tough programs. And I was like, wait a second, I don't think after my master's degree, I can just sign up for something like that. I also had like a wanderlust and I just really wanted to get out and see the world around me and itching to travel. So I took a detour.
Yeah.
And long story short, I wound up working in the wine industry and did a lot of seasonal harvest work all over Latin America, also New Zealand, Australia. And so while I was in Latin America working in Chile, got to travel around Mendoza. And my plan was kind of to head from Chile all the way up north to the US and then maybe work on another Northern Hemisphere vintage and hit another detour in Peru. So I was on a biodynamic vineyard in Chile, and they connected me with one of their biodynamic coffee producer friends. And I loved it, loved coffee. There was so much like overlap between wine and coffee that I just, you know, was done with the wine industry from that point forward, like fully switching gears to coffee. And came back to the U.S., did some roasting with some friends in Tennessee, and actually met Leo, my future research advisor, Leo Lombardini, and he kind of hooked me into graduate school. Cool. And that's how that all happened.
I love it. So maybe if we can just backpedal a little bit so we can just maybe explain what biodynamic means and what that means in Peru. I know you had mentioned that was like the first one ever certified there in the country. So if you wanted to share a little bit about what biodynamic farming is.
Yeah, I wasn't really familiar with the term, especially coming from like a chemistry background, like agriculture wasn't really my thing, but I've definitely like caught the agriculture bug by now. So I guess the real like way to explain what biodynamic is maybe to explain how it's different from organic. Sure. So you might see a lot of those certifications, organic, biodynamic. So biodynamic, it comes from Rudolf Steiner, has a lot of principles to do with kind of like homeopathy. But at least what is important to me for biodynamic is that everything has to do with the soil. All of the preparations are made on farm, a lot to do with kind of waste streams from like animal agriculture. Also really important that the animals must consume food from the farm, so not bringing in outside grain, anything like that. So a lot of composting, a lot of like soil-centric agriculture, a lot of kind of integrated pest management, maybe slightly different from organic. Everything and the entire farm must be certified biodynamic instead of just maybe a sector of your coffee field is organic. Sure. Something like that. And then it can get maybe, you know, a little bit into some mysticism. They do also plant like based on moon cycles mm-hmm. and solar calendar and all of that, or lunar calendar and all of that. Mm-hmm. But at least the core of it really to me is like focusing on soil health and making sure that, you know, whatever you're extracting is making its way back to the soil.
Yeah, I liken it akin to, you know, agroecology, permaculture, right? These agricultural systems that obviously each have their own nuances, but primarily really just focused on sustainability, closed loop, you know, cyclical cycles. And like, as you mentioned, focused on soil health. And we'll talk obviously a lot more about that as we get into your research. But I like this term that you use to describe yourself as a hemisphere hopper. I'm curious about, you know, how much of your interest in coffee was based on maybe the locations you were working at versus maybe some of the locations where vineyards and wineries were located.
Oh, yeah, huge for me. Just being like a product of somebody who loves the sun, love like sweating, you know, working outside all year round would be like ideal for me. So I do love wine growing climates and the fact that I could go from harvest season to harvest season in different hemispheres and kind of skip over that whole winter thing. It was really appealing to me. And it was just also perfect timing that coffee harvest like falls in the middle of those two vintages. And so that allowed me to travel and really get into coffee. So it was all like super fortuitous how I fell into it.
I love it. Is there a favorite coffee producing region that you love?
Oh, no. I don't think so. I think they're just all, you know, very tropical climates, super mountainous. I'm also, you know, Tennessee girl from the Appalachian Mountains, like just love mountain landscapes, lush greenery, all that, you know, good oxygen produced from trees. Good. So yeah, I don't think I could really choose one or the other. I still haven't had any opportunity to travel in coffee producing regions outside of Latin America and South America mm-hmm. included. So we'll see what when this is all over COVID-wise.
Good. Yeah, you can't make any favorites just yet.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so let's jump into then now where you are present day. You are a PhD candidate?
Yes, finally.
Yes, congrats. And you're working at the Center for Coffee Research. Want to just give us maybe a bit of a background on, you know, when the center was originated and what you're doing there and what it really stands for.
Yeah, so I think the center, Coffee Center itself is coming up on its fourth anniversary. And So I've been there ever since its first anniversary, so the last 3 years. And so the Center for Coffee Research and Education is actually housed within the Borlaug Institute at Texas A&M. So that's housed within Texas A&M. And I guess I kind of straddle two roles as a PhD student. I'm also in the Department of Horticultural Sciences. And so that's where I guess the majority of my funding comes from, and then research within the Coffee Center. And I guess just to, you know, give that plug, the mission statement for the Coffee Center is that they're, you know, working to improve quality and supply of coffee for and producer livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And so that's really at the core of everything that we do in the Coffee Center, is just really work to improve livelihoods of producers, most of whom are definitely not on the more profitable aspect or side of the coffee supply chain. And so that kind of goes hand in hand with a lot of what the Borlaug Institute does with international development. And I guess the historical perspective is that Texas A&M has been working in coffee development since the early 2000s. It started with some USAID projects, SPREAD and PEARL, whose acronyms I could not tell you. But a lot of that had to do with developing actually coffee processing infrastructure in post-conflict Rwanda. And so they were able to make huge gains in profitability for coffee producers in Rwanda. And that's sort of the legacy of coffee at Texas A&M. And then out of that has popped World Coffee Research, which their mission, so they are actually no longer an entity of Texas A&M, but their focus is really on developing hybrid varieties of coffee that are coffee leaf rust resilient, also climate resilient, and then also still high performing in terms of quality.
Awesome. So there's a big focus on the people, the planet, right? It's holistic in nature, focused on, you know, helping create resilience for this amazing crop that we all love. I'm drinking it now. And maybe just to give some background on who Norman Borlaug is and the significance of what he did with breeding and how that kind of then fills into this legacy that you guys are pursuing now. If you want to maybe just give a background on Norman Borlaug, if I can put you on the spot.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. So Norman Borlaug, what he brought to the world, they wrap it up in the Green Revolution. So he focused on a lot of wheat breeding for short hybrid wheat varieties that would not fall over in like huge wind storms or anything like that. So that would be like really unfortunate loss of yield for a wheat growing season if you lost your whole crop. So these hybrid varieties of wheat were also really high yielding. And then maybe, I guess, just to talk on the aspect of sustainability, there is a little bit of controversy in the fact that Norman Borlaug, you know, he developed high yielding crops, did a lot of things to help with poverty and food security. But wherever we have high yields, we also have high inputs. And so that's something that we talk about in the next green revolution, really tackling to make it a true green revolution. So getting away from some of those high inputs that could have detrimental environmental impact.
Yeah, I love it. And very aptly said, you know, it's always interesting to hold those two things very loosely, right? Because it's like, on one hand, yeah, he's got the Nobel Prize. He's like single-handedly attributed for the increasing population that the planet can now sustain because we can produce so much food on small amounts of land. But then that obviously comes at a cost of environmental degradation, intensive farming, and some of the negative consequences of that, right? And now that obviously maybe the potential negative impacts of a high population on the planet, and then, you know, if we're not using or living within our means within those populations, right, you get into other issues as well. So yeah, it's really interesting to kind of hold those two things together and find where can we find this balance of being able to produce food for everyone to be able to eat so we can address these food security, food sovereignty issues, but do it in a way that's sustainable. And so I think you really wrap that up really well and nicely. So sorry to put you on the spot there with a little ag history.
No, it's really good. So I always like to tell the story that I don't even know if Leo, you know, my research advisor, knows this. I didn't know what the word horticulture was when I got accepted to the PhD program.
That's crazy.
So I've like personally come a long way in like learning about, you know, agriculture, all that stuff. But I think it's just important to, you know, recognize, like, we all eat, we all, like, you know, take from agricultural systems, and I try to maybe get away from my ivory tower a little bit and try to, like, break stuff down so we're all speaking the same language.
It's huge and it's critical. And I love, there's a quote by Wendell Berry, and I'm going to butcher it, but the emphasis is really just on this idea that everybody is a part of the agricultural system. Everyone is a part of the food system. Whether you're a producer or a consumer, you're a part of it. And so you have a vested interest in this, for not only just for you to be able to survive and get food, but also for the sake of the planet and for future generations. So it's something that I really love about agriculture, because it's something that everybody needs, and it's every civilization's foundation. And so I find a lot of value in that. And it's interesting you bring that up, because I feel like we've almost had inverse trajectories in our graduate school experience, where, like, you were a chemist, I got into ag, and then I was an agriculture person who's now getting into chemistry. And so we've kind of, like, come at it at different ways. But that's what I think is so cool about agriculture, is that it can attract so many different talents and perspectives. And we need all of them in order to, again, address the next kind of green revolution, where we can do it in a sustainable way.
Totally. I always say that about coffee as well. Sort of like, whatever your skill set is, you can lend it to coffee if, you know, you're so inclined.
Yeah, it's so true. When I was down in El Salvador visiting a grower who's a good buddy of mine, you know, he was consulting with people at UC Davis in the food science fermentation labs, because he wanted to look at fermentation as an alternative form of processing to kind of bring about different types of flavors and aromas, et cetera, to the coffee. And I thought that was so interesting. Now people from fermentation science can get involved. It's like, there's so many things you can do to coffee, manipulate it, whether at the plant or at the cherry or the bean level. And so I find it super fascinating. So I kind of agree with you more.
Yeah, totally cool.
So let's jump in then to, like, what is the specific focus of your research? How are you applying chemistry to coffee quality, and what are you looking and addressing?
Yeah, so it's actually developed into maybe more than what I had imagined, you know,
of
when
course,
I signed
as
up.
Graduate school does.
Yeah, and so it really was like that experience in Peru that I had, like, even it was just a month working there on the farm, but just like seeing the whole farm as an organism and just really keying into how so it was La Chacra de Dago, the farm, and the Marin family, they're the ones that were just really obsessed about their soil and how much that impacted their coffee quality. And so I really took that idea and ran with it, trying to, you know, take my experience in the wine industry and lend that lens of a chemist to be able to, like, quantitate what is quality, how can soil improve quality. But then my PhD program, maybe, you know, out of fear for having something to do or not enough to do, I ended up taking on a post-harvest project as well. So now I, you know, say my dissertation title is the pre and post-harvest effects of coffee quality. And then I ended up conducting a systematic lit review on coffee quality effects from climate change. So it's really like multifaceted look at how quality can be impacted.
Is that published already?
Soon, not just yet.
That sounds interesting. Yeah. I want to read that.
Yeah, it was very good. Turned out
amazing.
Well.
So I have a question then. You talk about coffee quality, and I think for some people, they may define coffee quality like very differently. I'm curious then, how does a chemist or how does a researcher define coffee quality? What are the parameters or the things that you are quantifying to ascribe or attribute quality to a particular coffee product?
Yeah, it's a really valid question. And there are lots of different ways to define quality. And sometimes I catch myself in my writing being a little too vague, you know, which aspect of quality am I talking about at this moment?
Sure.
So I guess just generally, typically the coffee industry describes quality in terms of physical quality, as well as sensory quality in terms of the process of cupping, which is more of a grading process. And so you end up getting a raw number score. And maybe physical quality could lend some interesting things to the scientific process, but there's a lot of controversy in science, and sensory science specifically, about cupping and the quality score that is generated for coffee grading purposes. That number is just a number, and it doesn't really tell you much qualitatively about what you're tasting.
So just if I can pause you quickly. Yeah. So this number is coming from the Specialty Coffee Association, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's a couple of different certification processes, but cool. Yeah, generally.
And generally you're ranking it on the scale of 0 to 100?
Yes. And then we define specialty coffee, anything above about 80. So from that 80 to 100 range, you know, maybe 83, 85 to be a little bit more specific. Awesome. But yeah, that number, it can be arrived at through like multiple assessors, lots of different people agreeing that, you know, that's the score. So there is a little bit like power in numbers through statistics in that direction. But at least, you know, everything that I've learned at Texas A&M, working with Dr. Rhonda Miller, she's in the animal science department. She helped develop the coffee sensory lexicon, which is like a flavor library with Kansas State. Wow. And yeah, really huge. And so that is, and it was coming from the coffee industry as a need that there was basically not a agreed upon lexicon or way to talk about quality beyond that cupping score. So if we're talking about sensory science, we can also define quality in terms of consumer liking. So that's like more preference based, or descriptive analysis. And that's the method that I use. And so descriptive analysis uses something like a lexicon, which contain reference flavors and aromas. And so if we really want to know how quality is impacted based on management practices, if we have a tool like a lexicon, we can be really specific and talk about how flavors change and in what way. So that's the one of the methods that I've picked up to basically define quality.
Super cool. Well, and I think it's really needed, right? And I think you're getting at this point in the idea that, you know, a number is one, so concise and doesn't tell you the whole picture. But two, it's also a bit subjective unless you have these multiple assessors kind of having a sort of consensus on what that number is. But again, you know, consumers, like everyone, have different tastes and interests and things that they desire, right? And so having more of a description about that coffee might lend itself to a better understanding of what that is and how the consumer might react to it or accept it. So I'm curious then, maybe what are some of the terms that are being used? So if I'm understanding this properly, the idea is that a coffee, you could say, oh, this coffee has more caramel or vanilla. Are these like the reference lexicon words that you're using?
Yeah. And so I think, oh gosh, there's like 120 plus.
Oh, wow.
Descriptors that it ended up being a World Coffee Research project. So the World Coffee Research Arabica lexicon has defined, and the actual research paper is titled The Living Lexicon. So even early on, the researchers recognized that it needed to evolve for different people, different palates, sure. Different origin, like regions of origin, because how the lexicon was developed was maybe a little narrow. So to talk about how it works, you mentioned vanilla. And so vanilla is actually a really tricky one because it gets tied up with sweetness all the time. Mm. So that's one of the scents, the aromas that we could do it as a flavor as well. But we do a lot of training to kind of decouple sweetness, which is actually a basic taste, just like sugar. A sugar solution from vanilla, the aroma. And so our reference for vanilla, I think it's like vanilla extract on a cotton ball in a snifter with a watch glass on top. And so we would set maybe that vanilla level at reference point of 10 on a 16-point scale. And so we would train for weeks at a time and, you know, smell that vanilla reference and really hone in on, you know, that's our point on the scale. And then go back to our coffee and see if we detect any vanilla, not sweetness, but vanilla aroma, and try to tie that to that reference point.
So you're sitting in a room, you have all these capsules of different aromas, and you're smelling them, trying to train your nose so that when you then go to smell the coffee, to see if you can pick up those reference smells, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah, you got it.
What are maybe some other ones you have in those jars. You call them snifters?
Yeah, so that's like a whiskey, you know, one of those big whiskey glasses, the snifter. And so most of the things are prepared for the individual taster. So we just do like our own little set of kind of ramekins. One of my favorite ones was nutty, and I was working with some Latin American coffees, so definitely very nutty. And the reference was prepared by grinding up mixed nuts. And so it was actually just like a variety of mixed nuts that produced like the perfect nutty note. Maybe some not so good ones. We had like a musty dusty, which was literally like a damp towel that we kept in a jar. Yeah. And there are also some sugar, what was it? Sugar aromatics was like a sugar cookie. So that was a nicer one.
That's a good one. Yeah. So, much better than musty dusty.
It's pretty awful.
It's cool. You know, it reminds me of, have you seen the documentary Somme?
Oh yeah.
So, you mentioned before a lot of similarities between wine and coffee, but I feel like it's very similar where some of these sommeliers are talking about, oh, it smells like fresh cut garden hose or a fresh can true. Of tennis balls. It's like, okay, come on, guys. Like, this is nuts. But it's true. You need to have those reference scents to be able to then qualify that then on the actual products. So, super fascinating.
Yeah, totally.
So I have a coffee here right now. It says orange acidity with a lingering finish, hints of vanilla, burnt sugar, and chocolate. So I'm assuming then there's a panel of researchers like yourself that are cupping this, who are trained with these scents, and that's where they're getting these flavors or aromas from.
Yeah, more or less. So I have worked on the roasting and coffee brewing side as well in some coffee shops. And so those descriptors could be coming from the coffee farmer themselves if they have a lab where they're tasting their own coffee and kind of putting forward what they think their coffee tastes like. Maybe more likely that there is importer-exporter somewhere that has a much larger lab that is using their team to assign those flavor notes as a way to sell the coffee. Or if it's the roaster and they are performing the quality control on their side, they could be assigning those notes. And it could literally be just one person that is coming up with what they think that coffee smells or tastes like. Sure. And so, yeah, I think it can, you know, be accurate, but it also depends on maybe they're really busy and they didn't have time to do the quality control all the way, you know, not saying what other people's quality control practices are or are not, but yeah.
But it could be subjective, and there's maybe a bit of marketing that's happening in there that's not always leading to the highest level of accuracy.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, so let's go back to this idea of the connection between soil health and coffee quality. So obviously you want to have high quality. That probably is different for most people, but there's probably a consensus of a few scents or aromas that are rich in quality. I'm curious then, how does what you do in terms of managing the soil, promoting soil health, contribute to developing better quality for the coffee?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and one that I have spent the last 4 years of my life trying to answer. And I can't definitively say that I have the answer at this point, especially, you know, even if I do feel pretty confident about the results of my research, it's really only going to be, you know, for my unique environment, for my specific coffee variety, something like that. So I guess the idea started sort of, you know, maybe romanticized when I was working in Peru, but also kind of this like fuzzy idea of the French concept terroir, which is actually like literally earth. And so in the wine world, it's very well understood to have a designation of origin attached to the wine. And like you mentioned, that Somme, you know, Netflix series, people are really good at being able to tell exactly where a wine originated from. And a lot of that has to do with the cultural practices, so the management practices. And so the concept terroir, though it's romantic, it has to do with the soil, maybe a lot of those flavor descriptors that are key to a region aren't specifically due to the soil. But that's still a question that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm curious about, and sure, I haven't completely ruled it out. But at least for me, the way that I've gone about answering that question, you know, can increased soil health improve coffee quality? Specifically to my region, I'm working with like very clayey soils, and they tend to be full of like recalcitrant nutrients, you know, trapped up in the soil because of the highly acidic conditions. And so my way to answer that question is like looking at soil management. Can soil management practices improve soil health and thereby alter coffee quality? Still to be determined on, you know, what that result will be. But at least some key takeaways and like ways that I'm thinking about answering that question is that, you know, if you have healthy soils, you know, nutrients are fully available for the plant to uptake. You've got, you know, plant health there. If the plant isn't stressed, then it has everything that it needs to produce, you know, fully ripe, mature fruit that, you know, evolutionarily speaking, would be picked by the, you know, curious critter in the woods. But, you know, for us, maybe that ends up meaning like super ripe fruit that produces some wonderfully complex flavors and aromas when roasted. And so maybe preliminary evidence that I'm seeing kind of, because of COVID, I wasn't able to conduct the full descriptive panel. I ended up doing a consumer panel. And those consumers were actually not able to differentiate between my soil treatments that I applied in the field. I guess I could back up a little bit and talk about the soil treatments themselves. So I was looking at some liming agents to basically like control that soil acidity, looking at just straight dolomitic calcium carbonate to raise the pH and perhaps make nutrients available, as well as an organic complement. So still trying to, you know, use on-farm resources, getting this compost that's made on-farm back to the soil to maybe ameliorate some of those acidic recalcitrant conditions. And so I'm seeing that yes, plant health has been affected in the terms of leaf and seed and nutrient uptake, elevated zinc, which could have quality implications, also copper. And then as far as the taste panel, they were not able to differentiate between the coffee samples, but is that inherently a bad thing? You know, in science, we always talk about a null result. Yeah, right. We don't want to publish that.
Sure.
But I've been actually thinking a lot about it. So if we're including the sustainable management practices and they're not detrimentally impacting quality, you know, maybe we can maintain a level of quality that earns us a certain dollar amount, but we're also, you know, helping with ecosystem services, boosting soil health, you know, mm-hmm. doing all the right things that mm-hmm. we want to do in the farm.
Yeah. And, you know, in the world of soil, usually things are on a little bit of a longer timeline too, right?
Where, for sure.
You know, building soil health doesn't happen overnight or even in a single season. So maybe these are things that, you know, over time you'll start to distinguish between the differences. And if I can just go back maybe to explain the intention behind some of these soil amendments. So obviously, as you mentioned, you know, when you adjust the pH, you're affecting the bioavailability of the nutrients. And so if you have highly acidic soils, this might limit particular nutrients from being able to be taken up by the plant. So by raising the pH, you're essentially increasing your chances of allowing more nutrients to go into the plant, which can lead to then healthier plants, healthier products. And then for the second amendment was organic matter. So you're just trying to add compost to help promote organic matter. What is the significance of organic matter in soils?
Oh, so the compost actually does two things. Yes, there is the carbon component. So adding carbon, and carbon can be thought of maybe as a food source for microbes to help nutrient cycling, could also be seen as a shelter to also like help those microbes stay in place. But the compost that we're working with also has liming ability itself. And so it has a calcium carbonate equivalence of about 10. And so that was actually on par with the synthetic liming agent that we added. So yeah, just basically seeing like, okay, if all things are equal, does the compost, the carbon that we're adding actually, you know, add some extra benefits?
Cool. Perfect.
Yeah.
Some more of a synergistic effect there. So I love that. Okay, so you applied these treatments, you're improving the soil health, you saw in your tissue analysis that, yeah, in fact, these are becoming healthier plants. And then when people went to drink them, they didn't notice the differences. I'm curious then, how does that then play out on your chemical profiling? Are you seeing metabolically, maybe we can jump into the world of metabolomics here for a moment. You seeing separation in your chemical compounds, even though the consumers aren't detecting those differences?
Yeah, I hope so. I actually don't know yet.
Okay.
So I haven't been able to, yes, fully flesh out that research. But sure, if we want to define sort of what metabolomics is.
Yeah.
So maybe there's basically like a omics for everything now. Flavor omics is totally like...
Oh, no.
Ionomics, whole field. So omics technologies are usually like those big data questions, like high throughput, large sample sizes, big data, basically. But so to unpack like what metabolomics is, that technology. So if you're familiar with genomics or proteomics, those are all of the genes or the proteins within a system, an organism, a tissue type. And the metabolomics would be all of the metabolites or the small molecules that could be potentially derived from gene expression. And so we talk about, let's see, in my world, looking at the metabolites, I'm really obsessed with those flavor and aroma compounds.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could think of, again, like question of like, what is coffee quality? We can break it down into the volatile and the non-volatile aspects of quality. And so I'm more interested in the volatile aspect, which is all of those flavors and aromas, instead of maybe things that are dissolved within solution, the non-volatile aspect.
Cool.
So, yeah.
I love it. And so this is probably going to get way too nerdy for the people listening, but because I'm curious, I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
So the volatile compounds, are these going to be the ones coming through GC detection, or can you get the volatile compounds through LC detection?
Typically, LC liquid chromatography is going to be all non-volatile compounds. And so in terms of coffee, that's usually going to be things like sugar, a lot of your methyl xanthines, which are going to be like caffeine, for example, or a lot of the chlorogenic acids, a lot of the like bitterness elements in coffee. And then the volatile complement would be through gas chromatography. And so I'm doing like Headspace sampling. There's also a really cool technique that's out there that's GCMSO. So that's gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, olfactometry. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the scientist also gets to detect what flavors and aromas are coming off of the instrument with a sniff port.
Yeah, this is the nose, right?
The nose. It's the coolest thing.
It. So cool.
Yeah, so I guess just to back up a little bit, coffee is about 400, maybe 500 volatile compounds make up the signature of coffee, but really about 25 to 30 are odor active. And so if we had those core 25 to 30, then we could make maybe a synthetic coffee just with that complement of volatiles. And so I actually did get to try out the GCMSO sniff port.
Cool.
And it's so cool. So we were talking about chromatography. That's the separation science. And so the GCMSO separates all of the coffee compounds coming through the column so you can smell them individually instead of Amazing. That like bouquet of Sure. aromas that would hit you all at once. You're smelling the nice things, the vanilla, the caramel, the butyric acid, which is like the vomit, you know, spoiled milk that is a real thing. Very strong indeed. Yeah.
Butyric acid and musty dusty, guys. These are the ones you gotta look out for.
But it's all right, part of the bouquet, right?
It
at
is.
Low levels
it
as
is.
The complexity.
It's good. And so I'm assuming that these are then being separated out because they have different molecular masses, and that's how they're able to kind of go in at different speeds.
Yeah, exactly. And so separation science is really based off of boiling point and different, if you remember your like chemistry. So all of the like compounds are going to be withheld or like attached to the column for a longer time as you increase the oven temperature of the column, then you know, slowly by slowly, according to boiling point, those compounds will come off.
And so as they're eluting one by one, then you can smell them and get an understanding of what this smells like and how this chemical translates then to a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that sounds like a sweet job. I'm jealous.
Until the butyric acid hits.
Yeah, until that one.
I quit.
Oh, man, that's so fun. Okay, wow. Okay, so we're getting really nerdy. I apologize for everyone that's listening that isn't in tune with their chemistry, but hopefully this is making
trying to break it down.
This is amazing. You're doing a phenomenal job, much better than I am. I'm still very much so a chemistry noob, and so probably like the audience, I'm learning along with them. So I appreciate you sharing your knowledge on all that. I want to maybe try and bring it all home and sum things up here. So if there was maybe perhaps a major takeaway you're seeing so far from your research, what would that be? Or maybe a goal that you want to still achieve? You know, what's kind of one concluding thought you have about the work you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really comes from the systematic lit review on coffee and climate change. And it's something that I've like intuitively known just getting into coffee and, you know, reading a bunch about it, studying it. There are still so many gaps in the research and like our understanding, like connections between like what flavors and aromas actually smell like and those compounds that are associated. And so I guess my like one overarching goal through my career would be to like tie up a lot of those loose ends, you know, if the funding allows and my interest allows. But yeah, just trying to connect those dots and then also like always having the coffee producer or farmer at the heart of the discussion. And so that's why I do prefer and strive to conduct more on-farm studies, examining real-world conditions, and just trying to add that lens of science or lens of access that may not be there.
Yeah, for sure. Because at the end of the day, these are the people we're trying to help. You know, coffee is something that I think a lot of us take for granted in terms of how much effort and resources and how much people suffered to, you know, get it to us safely and so cheap, right? And so I love that you're keeping, you know, the farmer at the heart of that. So I guess in line with that, then if there's one thing you could communicate then to coffee consumers, what would that be?
Yeah, very bluntly, pay more.
Sure.
Yeah. So I mean, I really would like to see coffee treated more like a gourmet or specialty product. And still it's very much treated like this, like commodity product, a necessity that just gets us going throughout the day to really like elevate its status and how we consume it, to add a little bit more, you know, respect to the product.
Sure.
And so, you know, maybe, you know, pay more, that's putting it a little bluntly, maybe challenge your local coffee roaster to be a little bit more transparent with how much they're paying. So there are a lot of like leaders of the industry, and Phoenix Coffee out of Ohio is one of them. And they put forward like an excellent transparency report where they are breaking down exactly like dollars and cents for who gets paid what. Also, they have a lot of like anti-racism training programs for their staff and environmental aspects, like sustainability, you know, how they're trying to make their coffee service more green. So definitely, yeah, expect a little bit more out of who's making your coffee.
Yeah, I love that. So, you know, yeah, I guess educate yourself, but also, you know, demand that level of transparency from your coffee roasters and your coffee shops, because, you know, at the end of the day, as we've been talking about, you know, I think we have to continue to empower these farmers who are putting in the work and the time and the effort to deliver us this amazing product. And it is unfortunate. I've never really thought about coffee, and it's unfortunate that I haven't, as this kind of gourmet thing. You know, again, we keep drawing these similarities to wine culture and wine science. And I think it's a shame that they're not almost viewed similarly, in the sense that like wine, I think, is very revered and has like this cultural sophistication and willingness to pay, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars for a bottle. But that level of significance doesn't always translate to coffee. And I wonder if it's because we just drink it so frequently, or it's been so exploited for so long that we have this kind of relationship to it that's so cheap and simple and easy. Right. You have a pod that you can put in your coffee machine. You know, we've been so removed from the art and the kind of relationship that coffee has. So I think it's really amazing point that you bring up. And again, I think that's one thing I'm trying to put together with the series is just understanding the sustainability issues around coffee and being willing to pay more to support more people who are really struggling to deliver you this amazing gourmet product.
Yeah, you definitely hit the nail on the head. I mean, we can even think about maybe hops or the cannabis industry and how much we've elevated like our level of understanding of those specialty products. And I think coffee is there, especially like for those who are in the know for specialty products. You know, we're definitely demanding better quality and better transparency, but there is still a little bit of a disconnect that I'd like to see change.
Yeah. Amazing. I love it. Well, I know my hipster self has definitely wanted to learn more and more. And I really enjoy going to like the really nice roasters who do all the right things and are working towards that goal. So for the listeners, continue to support those people. And you said Phoenix Coffee.
Oh, yeah. Put a plug for those guys. Support them. They're awesome. Really good.
Anything else you want to plug? You want to share how people can find you or your research?
Yeah. So really like in the coffee world, Instagram is king. But I, as a PhD student, have had to sort of remove myself. So you can find me there as Distinctly Brinkley. But I'm trying to beef up my, you know, science Twitter side. So you can find me there at SC Brinkley, which is also my email address at tamu.edu if you'd like to contact me. And then just sort of like one other side project that I've been working on, which is sustain.coffee, the URL. And it's a really good way to like educate yourself, to learn more about coffee, all different aspects of sustainability, gender issues, that kind of thing.
Amazing. So this is a website you have been developing?
Yes. And so it is sort of like a repository of different types of research, a collection of abstracts from different fields, all linked around coffee.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so check out sustain.coffee. And yeah. I will drop your handles and tags in the show notes as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Well,
thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all about the lovely world of coffee chemistry.
It was my pleasure.